Thank you, Carrie. I think it's really fitting that Andrew and I are giving this symposium presentation today, because the first time I ever met Larry, I think, if my memory serves me right, was at a Sarah 17 meeting on phosphorus in Madison, Wisconsin, quite a number of years ago. And so we're very grateful to be here to present the phosphorus indices. This is a really excellent way of honoring Dr. Bundy's memory. So I think we all know the problem with phosphorus. This picture was taken in the Netherlands. The plants in the stream are doing just as well as the plants on the ground. I was reading an article in Science on my way out here from aquatic ecologists, and they suggested that we need to stop looking at just nitrogen or phosphorus and look at both nitrogen and phosphorus, particularly in freshwater systems. And I think this is really fitting for thinking about Dr. Bundy, because he did work both on nitrogen and phosphorus. And the issue of phosphorus came home to haunt us this summer. This is a picture of Lake Erie. I think we all know that the Toledo drinking water source was shut down for about a week this past summer because of harmful algal blooms that have been associated with phosphorus. We all, as agricultural scientists, know that this phosphorus is coming from multiple sources, but because this is agriculture that we're talking about, I want to focus on it for just a moment. And I'm going to give you some examples from my own state of North Carolina about agricultural phosphorus. This is the median soil test phosphorus in North Carolina. The majority of the states test high or very high in phosphorus. And note the red county right here, which has a median soil test of 200 to 250. Above 50, you don't need to apply any more phosphorus. So why? Well, we have long-term poultry operations that have helped load our soils with phosphorus. And the longest-term phosphorus from poultry has been exactly where you see the red county. In addition, the newcomer on the block is all of our swine CAFOs. And it's just coincidental that the swine and the poultry overlap, and we're starting to see very high soil test phosphorus. Now, in the introductory slide for this symposium, when they were talking about Dr. Bundy's work, one of the things he was looking at was the relationship between soil test phosphorus and soluble phosphorus loss. But least we think it all comes from animals, we have long-term tobacco production in North Carolina, which has certainly loaded our soils with phosphorus. So we have plenty of sources of phosphorus to our agricultural lands. Now, this is going to age me, but when I went to school, I learned that if we can control erosion, we could control phosphorus. I thought it was really great on the slide that was honoring Dr. Bundy that they were mentioning the fact that when he was looking at phosphorus, he was already recognizing all these different pathways that researchers have been looking at for the past 30 years. The release of dissolved phosphorus from the soil itself, and as you increase soil test phosphorus, you tend to increase dissolved phosphorus running off the soil. Recently, there's been a lot of interest and research on soluble phosphorus actually leaching through our soils into our drain tiles. There's some really good work throughout the Midwest showing this, and then our tiles are flowing into our streams, so we're obtaining more phosphorus through that pathway. We know there are ways to sequester phosphorus, either in the soil or the plants, but ultimately these phosphorus losses, whether it's a half a percent or 5% of the total phosphorus budget, can impact our water resources. And again, Dr. Bundy was very interested in looking at all of these pathways. As I mentioned, over the past 30 years, there have been a number of experiments looking at different loss pathways, and I think this is one of the more eloquent studies that was done by Dr. Buda in Pennsylvania. He looked at soil test phosphorus levels in this particular landscape. This is higher up, this is lower by the stream. Then he also measured the amount of runoff, significantly higher towards the stream. and was able to calculate the total phosphorus loss. So the soil that had the lowest soil test phosphorus by far had the greatest amount of total load because of the amount of water leaving that particular landscape position. So we know that we have two different factors that really affect the loss of phosphorus from our agricultural landscapes. We have high sources, we have high transport. Generally, when those collide, we have some critical source area issues. That is, there's this kind of rule of thumb where you lose 80% of your phosphorus from 20% of the lands. We also use that same rule of thumb for sediment. I think as we start looking at phosphorus losses, particularly subsurface phosphorus losses to drain tiles, we may have to change this rule somewhat, just like when we think about nitrogen losses. It may be that soluble phosphorus in those landscapes are more ubiquitous than the 80-20 rule would suggest. But nonetheless, there are these critical source areas. So as scientists were starting to understand that there were different loss pathways and we had this issue with too much phosphorus, in 1999, in kind of a joint statement between EPA and USDA, they said we need to think about how to control phosphorus in a better fashion, and we're going to look at the development of phosphorus indices. And this was actually written into the NRCS 590 standard that was implemented in 1999. When the scientists were looking at the phosphorus indices, just like the slide I had a few slides before suggested, there are different components. You need to look at sources. What's your soil test phosphorus? What's your source of phosphorus that you're applying? Is it an animal waste? Is it commercial fertilizer? How are you applying that phosphorus? Are you putting it on the surface? Are you knifing it into your soil? So there were these kinds of issues to think about. As important, and perhaps even more importantly, we really need to think of transport. And we had always considered erosion potential, but in this new transport matrix, we also needed to start thinking about runoff of dissolved phosphorus over the surface, leaching potential, which again is increasingly important in many of these landscapes, and not least proximity to streams, because the further you are from the stream, the less likely the phosphorus is to get into your water resource. So in 1999, when they developed their new 590 standard, NRCS said to every single state, okay, here are this general framework, now you all go off and do good things, but you're going to need to address both nitrogen and phosphorus within 2 years. So every state was given 2 years to think about how they were going to implement these new phosphorus criteria. So part of the reason of doing this is they wanted to let the ag community have a chance to fix its phosphorus problems. And part of it was because they saw this issue with concentrated animal operations. North Carolina is a perfect example. Maryland, different places throughout the country. But NRCS, being the organization it is, also wanted to allow each state some kind of autonomy because there are true agroecological differences within different states. So they said to the states, you have three choices. Develop a phosphorus index, use a site-specific environmental threshold, or use a soil test recommendation. Now, initially, states like Texas said, okay, we're going to go with a soil test recommendation. But after implementing it, it became clear to them it was unworkable, and so they went to the phosphorus index. Some states like Kentucky did a hybrid. They said, yeah, we're going to do a soil test recommendation. If you're below a certain level, you're okay. If you're above a certain level, then you need to do a phosphorus index. And some states just said, okay, we're going to do phosphorus index. So I believe at this point in time, 47 of the 50 states use the phosphorus index. And so I've been talking about the phosphorus index. I know many of you know this intimately. For those of you that don't, let me briefly go through what was proposed by Jerry Lemunyan and Gilbert in a much earlier era, in 1993. They said, we know there are these transport mechanisms, that affect phosphorus loss, and then there are our source components that affect phosphorus loss. And they said what we're going to do is we're going to weight these factors relative to the importance we believe they have. So as was often the case in those days, they saw soil erosion as the major factor in the transport. They also had different levels of these factors. So for instance, I'm going to use soil erosion as the example. They had low, medium, high, very high, a certain amount of erosion associated with each one. So for instance, if you had 5 to 10 tons of erosion on that particular field that you were running soil test phosphorus in, a phosphorus index on, you would get a 2. But that 2 had to be multiplied by the weighting factor, so now you had a score of 3 for soil erosion. You'd go through and you'd do it for all of the transport factors, all of the source factors, you'd find the category, the number associated with it, you'd multiply it by the weighting factor, and at the end of the day, you added all of those factors together for a total score. The question is, what did that total score mean? Each of the states, as they developed their own phosphorus index, and again, they were given pure autonomy to do this any way they saw fit, many of them used the additive index that Le Monnier had developed. Some of them took it directly, some of them modified it a little bit. Alabama took it and said, we're going to add proximity to stream as a transport factor. Other states said, no, we don't want to do additive, we want to do multiplicative. So we'll add the source, we'll add the transport, and then we'll multiply them together. And some of us were really stubborn and we said, forget it, we're going to do something entirely different because we, at least in North Carolina, we had 3 distinct physiographic areas. And we said, we're going to try and calculate erosion, runoff, leaching, and source and add them together for a loading rate of phosphorus, pounds of phosphorus per acre per year. And there were a number of states that did this. So what you see in the bottom here is a number of different state phosphorus indices. Many folks computerized it through Excel spreadsheets. Some folks actually put it together. And as I was saying 2 slides previously, each state at the end had a total value. But what did that total value relate to? Well, NRCS in their 590 standards said, if your phosphorus index rating is low or medium, you can continue managing with nitrogen. If it's high, you have to think about only applying enough phosphorus for crop removal. And if it's very high, no more phosphorus. So it was great. Things were going along swimmingly. In 2000, Maryland said, whoops. In 2000, they said, we like this so well, we're going to adopt it as a state regulatory standard. So now the NRCS 590 phosphorus index standard, which was voluntary, went to a regulatory standard in 2000 for Maryland. And many other states followed suit at this point. Now, after all the states had implemented their phosphorus index and had some time to think about it, these questions started popping up. Is it effective? Is it equitable? Is it sustainable? And my personal favorite is, how often is it even used? So in 2010, NRCS said, we're going to revise our 590 standard, particularly the phosphorus index part, because they still had some concerns about water quality. They were continuing to see a lot of animal waste application applied on a nitrogen basis. There was a study done in the South that showed there were problems with phosphorus indices going from state to state. And last but not least, there were still some problems in the Chesapeake. So I want to show you very quickly this study that was done in the southern area. About 2 years after we all finished our phosphorus indices in the South, we decided to compare them across state boundaries. So we put together scenarios. The scenarios, for instance, the one I'm showing you, it's a cropped situation, Malic 3P of 150, litter application of 4. And what you see is that, we'll take this one, Tennessee is adjacent to Alabama, so far so good, they both have very high. Kentucky is adjacent, it is high, and Georgia and North Carolina are both medium. So if you cross state boundaries, Tennessee is surrounded by all those states, you end up with very different phosphorus indices. So NRCS wanted to get rid of some of these problems, and they asked Sarah 17, the group that you see here, to look at their proposed new 590 standard. The most important thing we said was that phosphorus indices are a tool. They're just one tool in a toolbox. You need to think about phosphorus in different ways. We also said, and I'm just going to put all these up, that every state phosphorus index should meet all of these criteria, be directionally and magnitudinally correct, be comparable across state boundaries so you don't have the problem the southern team found. The other key conclusion was this paragraph is really important, and you all can read as well as I can, but NRCS was proposing APEX as the tool that all states would use for their phosphorus index. And what we said is, be careful. You can't use one tool because you have too many different situations. We also said, if you're going to choose to use one tool, you better make sure that you have enough money that it's validated throughout the country. So what we decided to do was work together as a team to see how well these different models would work. And we have these five different projects. Two of them are state only. Three of them are regional projects. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about these, except to say, if you look at the three regional projects, the Chesapeake, the Southern, and the Heartland, they all have similar kinds of direction. They're all finding water quality information associated with either watersheds or plots. They're collecting land treatment information, and then they're using these data sets in models such as SWOT, APEX, and DrainMod. They're comparing the water quality data to the P indices. They're comparing the water quality modeling data to the P indices, and they're also using the water quality data in their water quality modeling. In the Heartland, it's very similar, except they're just working on one particular model. They're using APEX, and they're using both out-of-the-box and calibrated, and then they'll modify their phosphorus indices based on their modeling results, and they'll try and make their phosphorus indices in these four states more comparable. In Wisconsin, they're looking at field runoff data. And what they want to ultimately do is look at field conditions and management practices that minimize phosphorus loss to frozen soils. Whoops. Okay. The southern region is very challenging. It's a very large region. Again, we're collecting water quality data. We're comparing our phosphorus indices against this. We're using several different models. We're looking at them one against the other, calibrated and uncalibrated. And hopefully at the end of the day, we can have better phosphorus indices that are more similar across state boundaries. And Ohio is really important because they're looking at tile drains and phosphorus losses, and they want to develop a better phosphorus index. So we want to get away from this. We've learned that there are the modeling efforts are great, and they've already made some very important contributions and changes to these models. But ultimately, our environmental outcomes are going to be because we use better agronomics. It's not because of one tool, P-index. And I think with that, I'm out of time. Okay.